I am so humbled and honored and thankful to be here. The last time I was in Springfield for any extended period of time, I guess I just need to confess I'm hoping I'm at the right church. The last time I was at Springfield, it was in the, I've been in Springfield a few times, but this extended period to work with the church, it was in the mid-90s, and Springfield was putting on a big work fest, a big work camp. Area-wide church youth groups were doing service projects. Do they still do that some? Well, we were painting people's homes. That was the big thing. We were going into older parts of town and painting those turn-of-the-century homes. And maybe my memory may fail me, but some places in Springfield have, for instance, 8th Street, 8th Place, 8th Drive. So I was supposed to be in charge of a crew of all these teenagers to paint 205 8th Street or something like that. So I showed up, of course, at 205 8th Place, and I said, "We're here to paint your house." She said, I don't know anything about that." And I just thought, bless her sweet senile heart, we're going to go ahead and paint her house. So, without any sort of warning, she got her house painted, and I thought we did a great job. But at the end of the work camp, people said, "Well, there's still one more house, 205 8th Street, that hasn't been painted yet. Adair, that was your house." I said, "No, I painted it." And we went back and looked, and I had painted a house a block over. Well, the news people enjoyed that. So in the mid-90s, there was some news about this work fest and this woman who got her house painted. She had just this mysterious crew showed up and painted her house. We got that other house painted real quick, though, too. So sunset, Church of Christ, I'm at the right place on the right street. I know that you don't want your right hand to know what your left hand is doing. But that doesn't keep the rest of the brotherhood from finding out what you are doing. And you have been quietly, discreetly doing the will of God here in Springfield. Quietly, anonymously, self-emptying this church into other new life, resurrection, new churches springing up. And that's been going on in the brotherhood. You can't help but hear about that. And so we are taking notes, and many, many other churches are wanting to become the kind of church that you are. I have respected Joe Bright for a long time from afar. He was a mentor to my best friend, John Ogren, at a dark time in his life. John just finished his PhD. And he's ready to start his career now and is at about 50. And Ross Cochran says that if he had to listen to one man preach on a steady, ongoing basis, it would be the substantial nourishment kind of preaching that comes from the Christ-centered preaching of Joe Bright. I did the premarital counseling for Laura and Blake. And just before I got up here, I thought, "Well, I hope they're doing okay. Laura and Blake doing okay?" before I put a feather in my cap there. He said they're doing great. So anyway, I understand that this is a time of transition for this church, that this is a time of recognizing and acknowledging new leaders. And I can't imagine a better foundation for thinking about new leadership than focusing on the ultimate leader, the true leader, who has true power and true influence, and that is Jesus Christ. In Philippians 2, the passage that was read, the question is this self-emptying, this emptying of himself, making himself nothing, is this in contrast to God or in keeping with his character? The passage says it's not just a passage about Christ. Many scholars think that this is a hymn, a song that Paul is citing, reminding them of, and saying, just like that Christ hymn, your attitude needs to be like that. Well, that may or may not be the case, but the question that I have about that text is this self-emptying, this downward, this condescension of Christ, this immersion into the human drama, this self-humiliating posture that Christ takes, is that in keeping with the character of God or in contrast to the character of God? The first word there that is typically translated, although, this reading said, who, though in nature God did not consider equality with God. There's another way of translating that. That word can be also causal. And there's a number of scholars that say there's a intended causal kind of double entendre there. Yes, although, even though he's God, he emptied himself. But that same word can be translated, because he's God, he emptied himself. And it could be that both of those senses are sort of meant there. Perhaps some say this is a contrast with Adam. Do you remember one of the temptations, one of the reasons that the serpent was able to lure Eve into taking that fruit? Take it, for you will be like God. So think about Adam. Though in very nature, not God. He was made in the image of God, but he was not in very nature the same as God. Who in very nature, not God, considered equality with God, eat it. For if you eat it, you will be like God. Considered equality with God, something to be grasped. Contrast Adam with Christ, who, though in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, but he emptied himself. Some say this is a contrast with Caesar, that Philippi was known as a colony of Rome par excellence, and that there would have been numerous images of Caesar, and Caesar claimed to be God. On the coinage of the day would be Caesar Divi Filii, Caesar Divine Son. Though in very nature not God, considered equality with God something to be grasped, something to be stamped on the coins, something to be set up in idle fashion in colonies all over the empire. Though not in very form God, he considered equality with God something to be grasped. And so this version of leadership, this version of power, Christ's version of power, shows us true influence, true power, true leadership, humanity done right, rulership done right, revealing what God is actually like. Also in contrast with Caesar, in Mark chapter 12, Jesus says, you know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must become your servant. And whoever wants to be first must become slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for all. God in Christ shows himself to be vulnerable. He comes close enough to get hurt. This is what true leadership looks like. He voluntarily suffers with us and for us. He participates with us in our suffering in this cross-shaped life. Now, certainly, we see his passion, we see his suffering on the cross. But do we see that his entire life is one of self-emptying? Well, I want to just journey through the Gospel of Mark kind of quickly. Mark is known as the Gospel, all the Gospels show the suffering of Christ, but Mark is known as the Gospel that most poignantly emphasizes the suffering of Christ. and not just at the passion formal, passion proper, but throughout his life. His own baptism is a participation with sinful Israel. And we'll talk about that later. But very early on, chapter 1, he's wanting to sneak off to a place while it's still dark so that he can pray. But the disciples seem to roll over and find the vacant mat, and they find him and they look for him, and they look for him and they find him and they say, "Everyone's looking for you." Jesus knows what it's like to not be able to get away, not be able to find orientation, not be able to connect with God. There's constant demands on his time. Some of you in here know what it's like to have constant demands on your time. Jesus understands that. A couple of places in Mark, Jesus and his disciples skip meals. That must have been a big deal in Judaism, to skip a meal. Not for any sort of religious observance, but simply because they might have done that too. Many did. Jesus was actually noted for not particularly fasting as much as the others. But he did skip meals because he was so busy. There's a couple of times in Mark because of the demands on his time, because he was so busy, like in chapter 3, verse 20. He skipped meals. I wonder if some of you can remember a time in your life when you were just simply so busy. It wasn't because you were dieting. It wasn't because you were fasting. But your schedule just got a little bit hectic and you skipped meals. When I asked that in some of my, sophomore classes, three quarters to all of their hands go up. They've skipped meals because they've just been too busy. Jesus understands micro suffering. Just minor, mundane inconveniences of this life. He's a leader that has voluntarily chosen to experience life with us on our terms. You run into people, perhaps in Springfield, who have had a bad experience with the church. "I'm not interested. I've had a bad experience with religion." In chapter 3, verse 20 and following, the religious leaders come down, the big shots from Jerusalem come down, and they want to find out what's going on with this Jesus, these things that they've heard. They hear he's casting out demons. And you know what these religious leaders say? They say it's by demons that he's casting out demons. It's by Beelzebub that they listen to him. Perhaps he himself is demon-possessed. I want you to know that Jesus, as much as anybody, knows what it's like to have a bad experience with religion. His own family thinks he's out of his mind right there in chapter 3, verse 20. Dysfunctional family tensions. I wonder if there's anybody in this room that needs to know that Jesus knows what it's like to have tension in the family. He understands mundane, micro, ordinary human difficulties. Jesus, acknowledging that tension, said later in that chapter, "Who are my mother and my brothers but those who do the will of God?" Relativizing that blood relationship. We skip to Gethsemane in chapter 14, verse 32. Gethsemane, the word just means oil press. It's a place where we find that Jesus went often to reorient, to get away from the crowd in Jerusalem. And as he's in Gethsemane, the narrator says he becomes deeply distressed and troubled. In the original language, there's just two words that we translate distressed and troubled. But the deeply is added because we distressed and troubled don't quite cut it. We have to intensify it by adding a third word. Deeply distressed and troubled. One author, theologian said, James Dunn said, that these two words actually connote the outermost limits of horror and terror. The outermost limits of horror and terror. The narrator, describing Jesus' affect in Gethsemane, says he was horrified He was terrified. Jesus himself speaks to his disciples. He confides in them. He makes himself vulnerable. He opens up to them. And he says to them, "My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death." My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. I wonder if there's anybody here this morning. I don't want you to raise your hands. It's too intense. It's perhaps too personal. But I wonder if you would. If I did ask, if there's anybody in here who's ever been in this place where your soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. Have you ever been in that dark corner of human existence where there's nothing you can do, it seems, but curl up in the fetal position and cry? I want you to know that this leader voluntarily subjects himself to that experience, and he curls up with you in that corner as one who understands, as one who suffers with us. The way Mark narrates this passage, it says that he goes on a little further and he falls to the ground. He collapses. He staggers. He is so overcome physiologically. This emotion affects his physiology that he cannot hold himself up. And he falls to the ground and he prays, "Take it from me, God. Take this cup from me." You know, this is the one place in all of the Gospels where the Aramaic is carried over. And he relates to God as Abba, Father. We know he did that. Paul records that he did that. And Paul uses the same language, that the Spirit within us cries out, "Abba, Father," in Romans 8 and also in Galatians 4. And I think Paul got that from Jesus. Now, Jesus, when he teaches his disciples to pray, says we are to say, "Our Father." Jesus in the temple, when he's little, says, "I had to be about my Father's business." All through John, he's talking about, "I can do nothing without the Father." But here, it's the only place in the Gospels where we actually see on the lips of Jesus this intimate Abba, Father. It strikes me that it's at this place of utmost despair and horror and terror and overwhelmed to the point of death where he collapses that he calls God Abba, Father. That at this moment of suffering, there is a moment of intense, dear intimacy. Some of you who have been in bleak circumstances, moments, periods of suffering, might know that kind of intimacy with the Father. My wife and I have been through a tough couple of years. Actually, my wife particularly has been through a tough couple of years. She was diagnosed with triple negative breast cancer a couple of years ago and has been through all of the radical chemo and surgery and radiation. But as we were beginning that process, our first surgery, we got there early to the doctor in Little Rock, and we didn't know what to do with ourselves because we were there about 30 minutes early, and we took a little walk, this Baptist Medical Center, and they had a pond at the end of a sidewalk, a park bench, and we just sat down, knowing that this is a long journey we're about to embark upon. And I just started praying. And as I was praying, my eyes were open. I'm looking at the pond sitting next to Amy. And there was this shadow of a cross. There was a huge cross. It's part of the landscape behind us that overshadowed us. And I have to be honest with you. I mean, I've talked about this, I've preached about this, I've written about this, but I've never had an emotional connection with the cross, with just seeing a cross. I see him so much. You become familiar with the jewelry and the ornamentation. But at that moment, as we're crying out to God, in this moment of despair, the message was this: I'm with you. I suffer with you. I know that place. I know what you're feeling. This most powerful one, this leader of leaders, God Himself, has joined us in vulnerability, suffering with us, alongside us. Some of you have had best friends disown you. Some of you have had friends turn on you, betray you. This is the story in Mark chapter 14. Some of you have experienced abuse. Jesus was physically abused. There's more that I could say about that, but with children present, I want to show some restraint, perhaps during the adult Bible class. Jesus says, my God, why have you forsaken me? At the end. The mystery of mysteries is that God Himself and Jesus Christ knows what it's like to feel forsaken by God. There are some of you that there's been times in your life, and maybe right here today, you feel abandoned by God. Jesus Christ is a leader who voluntarily subjected himself to experience the full gamut of human emotions, and one of those emotions might actually be the feeling of abandonment. I know that he's quoting Psalm 22, and I know that there's all sorts of theological interpretations here. Did God have to turn his back away from him as he takes the sin of the world upon himself? There's lots of questions about that. There's lots of speculation about that. I know one thing, though. Jesus, at this point, is quoting Psalm 22 because he feels forsaken by God. I've heard sermons. I've read books. Seen sermon series on the last words of Jesus. They might take a whole chapter or a sermon and unpack, for instance, "It is finished." Unpack, "Today you will be with me in paradise." Unpack, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And all of the last words of Jesus, they say that there's seven of them. Words of Jesus on the cross. But I want to say that there's actually one more. It's not actually a word, but it needs to be the eighth chapter or the eighth sermon in a series. And that is his very last utterance, his very last vocalization in Mark. It's just an inarticulate bellows, a scream. With a loud cry, he breathed his last. This is true influence, true power. True leadership, one who makes himself vulnerable, one who comes close enough to get hurt, one who voluntarily takes upon himself suffering for the sake of real relationship with us. Jesus said, "And if I be lifted up from the earth, will draw all men unto me." Jesus understands true influence. He will draw all men unto him, not by coercing their love, but by demonstrating, as the passage was so beautifully read this morning, demonstrating his love for them. "If I will be lifted from the earth," again, double entendre, lifted from the earth in the form of a cross, "then he will also be ascended." He will be lifted from the earth and will draw all men unto him. And so as we experience the Son in the form of a servant, he is not denying his divine form. He is not concealing his divine form. He is not renouncing his divine form. He is revealing it. He is showing us what God is like. He is, as Romans 5 says, he is demonstrating his love for us. In an attempt to grasp this mystery, theologian Jürgen Moltmann says, "God is not greater than he is in this humiliation. God is not more glorious than he is in this self-surrender. God is not more powerful than he is in this helplessness. God is not more divine than he is in this humanity. Perhaps you're here this morning and you're ready to respond to His love. You're ready to confess Jesus as Lord. You're ready to identify with Him in death and resurrection, being baptized into the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Or perhaps you're a Christian, but you've not aligned your life with the life and death of Jesus Christ. You're a Christian, but you're not living out your baptism, which is a baptism of self-emptying. And that is the life that is exalted and raised. The gospel calls us to be like Christ, to love like Christ, and to lead by serving. Whatever your need is, turn to Jesus, come to Him while we stand and sing.